time for The Daily Review, a podcast dedicated to reviews and discussion of TV, movies, and books. Look for us at Daily Review on Facebook and Twitter and dailyreview.com on the web. That's DaleyReview.com. This is Paul Daly, and I'm here with my wife, Caroline, again.
Hey, guys.
We have just come back from the premiere of the second season of The Leftovers.
It was so exciting to receive the email from HBO that we were invited to come. Could not wait. We were gathering our National Geographic and any questions we could think of we might want to ask everybody, and we were off to Austin.
We also were able to take part in what they called the fan zone, which was basically the crowd of people surrounding the red carpet as the celebrities came in. Caroline had this great idea of bringing along our copy of the National Geographic as a way to try to have some conversation piece between us and any of the actors or creators as they came in, and it worked great.
It was so funny because the fan zone really took the mission of getting the National Geographic signed by everyone very seriously. So every time one of the talent would come out of a car, or if it was a producer or director, Tom Parada, Damon Lindelof, anyone, the whole crowd would like crowd surf my National Geographic over to the person, or they would be directed like, come over here, we have a National Geographic for you to sign. Every single time they would come over and take it from my hands, I was met with the same look on their face like, how did you get this?
It was pretty cool.
So we have the May 1972 issue of National Geographic, which, as you season one watchers know, was a key piece between Senior Garvey and Kevin and their conversations of what was going to happen next and what was this all about. We had found a copy and been looking through it to try to find little clues all along the way.
And our copy had little post-it notes sticking out of the side where we had scratched notes about what we thought the significance of something on that page might be.
Damon was so happy. We have such a cute picture of him doing this like open mouth like, what? It was so funny. I loved it. So we got it signed by a number of cast members as well as Tom Parada and Damon Lindelof. I have to say,
Mimi Leader,
yes, and then many of the actors. We got a chance to really shine a spotlight on it with Turk Pipkin. He was hilarious. In season two, he is the actor that is up in the tower in the center of town, and he took the time out to do like an entire show and tell on the red carpet. Like, he took my National Graphic, he opened up, he's like, look, everyone, this is the cave painting. Like, he actually explained different parts. It was awesome.
Look for pictures. I have a movie of it, but I'll try to post what I can on Instagram or our webpage or Facebook or something. You will see.
DailyReview.com.
You will see what happened, what she's explaining.
And it was great. The main thing about it is that it lets all you fans know out there that this group of people are very receptive to your excitement for the show. Any which way that you can show them how much you're into it, how much you're reading along and you're watching and trying to find those little clues, listening to the music they are choosing and what books people are reading, it really makes a difference. They were very excited that we had been paying that much attention.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but we weren't supposed to bring anything to get signed. And they came over to us. Damon came directly over to Caroline with that National Geographic.
There was a handler there that seemed to know that Damon and Tom Parada would care a lot that we had the National Geographic. So as soon as they came out of the car, she directly pointed at us and said, you need to go over there. You need to see what they have.
It was gratifying.
It was pretty awesome.
To get that.
Yeah, it was so exciting.
From the people that we care about.
Absolutely. And just generally get that confirmation that it was right to have sought out the National Geographic and to look for it and that there were clues in there and to keep reading it. It was very exciting. In addition, HBO was so gracious as to give complimentary swag bags. So we got some t-shirts and water bottles, M&Ms, only blue and white. So we
figured some leftovers white wristbands.
I feel like in the M&M bags that all the other colors might have been departed. So we only had white and blue.
Spooky.
And so we sat upstairs in the Paramount Theater in the balcony, and the talent were right below us. So we had the opportunity to see Justin Theroux and Jennifer Aniston. They were super fast on the red carpet. Their strides were like 6 feet long because they really took like one, two, they were inside. So we didn't really get a chance to take pictures or ask them to sign anything, that type of thing.
I'll put the videos up and you'll see.
Yeah, and pretty much everybody else, though, they started to walk in, and it's like they thought better of it. It was kind of interesting because they would take a couple steps, and they would go right in the door, and then it was like they noticed that we were all there and that we were excited to see them, and so almost every single one followed the same pattern. They'd take a step or two, they'd turn, they'd realize we cared and we wanted to say hello, and then they'd turn, and then they'd come back towards the fan zone and be like, wait a minute, like, what am I doing? Yes, of course I'll take a couple pictures.
Most interesting was Chris Zilka. He actually went in and then kind of came back out and then went to both sides of the fan zone to greet people individually. And then for some, whatever reason, Chris Eccleston seemed to come out of just nowhere.
Yeah.
He didn't come out of a car. He seemed to come from around the corner.
Yeah, he did just kind of walk up the block. So old Doctor Who was friendly and he signed the National Geographic and he was nice about it. Chris Zilker was like the first one to sign the National Geographic. And when he looked at it, he was like, oh my God. It was like he saw a ghost. It was so funny. He was like, oh my gosh. Oh my. He was so funny. So he was very friendly, very nice. It was awesome.
The HBO president had a speech. Tom Perrotta had a speech. But Damon put his signature humor into his speech, where he said, are you guys ready to get your bleak on? It was just like, because he was acknowledging
how depressed everyone had really felt during season one.
He was acknowledging what people had been saying about it. But on the other hand, they showed us the first and second episodes. After watching those two episodes, it was kind of like, okay, I've addressed that. Thank you very much. We can move on.
So Tom Perrotta and Damon both acknowledged moving the show from New York to Austin and the surrounding areas. They're mainly filming in Lockhart, Texas, which has been the home of many, many, many different shows, movies, documentaries. We were surprised to see Lockhart's long history of film, TV, and documentary history. It's pretty interesting. If you get a chance to head out there, there's lots of stuff to see. You can absolutely see the homes that they were shooting in. The town square is very, very obvious where...
It's not a special effect. They really built that building there.
Yeah, that building is really there. I mean, not they, the town. That's
right,
the town's
right.
Building.
It's historically been there for 100 years.
That's the town's building there, that main town square, like...
I don't know if it's City Hall, but it's
kind of, I think it is City Hall. So it kind of looks like it, but it's very grandiose.
We had a chance to spend a day taking pictures of the locations, and we did. We got the Murphy's house, the Garvey's house, the house where the bride stands in front watering the lawn.
Matt Jameson's home and church.
And we're going to do two things. We're going to put pictures of this stuff on our own webpage, but as a guest blogger for WatchingTheLeftovers.com, HBO's own website for The Leftovers fandom, I'm going to post an article there also telling about Lockhart, how it became Jarden, and some of its, just a smidgen of its cinematic history, plus our pictures comparing what we saw in the trailers, because that's mostly what's been shown, and the pictures that we took in person.
It was amazing to actually get a chance to see as you're driving down the street and then all of a sudden you're like, ah, that's the Murphy's house. Like, so funny. It's nice that they are shooting on location at real homes instead of, you know, in Hollywood on a sound set somewhere. I do feel like it's going to give the entire town a completely different feel, which is wonderful because everything that we've been reading about Jarden is that it's a character unto itself, that it has its own magical mystique, and that I think it's awesome that they actually chose a physical town that exists to give that spirit a real place to be.
There is a definite...
Paul and I were talking as we were going through Lockhart. Now, we hadn't seen episodes 1 or 2 of season 2 yet when we were in Lockhart the first time. And when we were going around, the mix of the architecture of the homes, the trees, which are these...
gigantic ancient oak trees.
Yeah. And if you think of how maybe a weeping willow tree makes you kind of feel this sadness or whatever, there's something about these trees, the way that they angle off in these unnatural directions that trees are supposed to go.
These don't grow up, as out.
Yeah, and they kind of grow in this kind of like gnarled hand kind of way where the limbs just sort of reach out and they're some are touching the ground and some are sort of unnaturally wound around things. It's all very interesting, but it does give this very horror movie / supernatural type feel. The town itself even without there being any type of location being chosen for a specific shot, had some really interesting vibes. It was all a little eccentric, I guess is the right word. So Paul and I were walking down an alley and we're just walking along, and underneath this tree branch where there's some shade, there were just two simple, tiny student school chairs that just looked completely out of place, like two ghosts just like had a tea party and left, because there was no people around. There was nothing that made that make any sense.
We enjoyed our visit, and if you are interested in seeing how the real life meets Hollywood, I'd encourage you to go check it out, because it's pretty much just right there for you to see.
On our website, dailyreview.com.
So, as I mentioned, we saw the first two episodes, but we are not going to spoil anything. We are just
definitely
going to
not
talk about the first episode that was aired last night on HBO.
And we tried hard to not let knowing the second episode color too much of what we thought about episode one. Starting off with a brand new feel, The Leftovers definitely have taken a softer / more whimsical, I'm going to say, approach to the credits. Before, if you remember, we had sort of this Vatican-style church fresco up on the ceiling kind of feel that had these very forlorn characters reaching up to the heavens. And
whether or not you attributed the departure to any kind of act of God, the intro to the previous season definitely had a wrath of God sort of feeling.
Absolutely,
to it.
Yeah. So this was very different, and I think they were trying to incorporate a Southern feel to it. Now,
you think?
Here's the thing. Paul and I are both from Texas, and the town that they have moved the story to is in Texas. We would like to kind of speak to the music a little bit. So the new song, Let the Mystery Be, I have no problem with. I like the words to the song. I understand. The basic idea is that they're telling the viewer point blank, people have ideas, we don't know, but we're going to let the mystery be. Basically meaning you're not going to know exactly what the departure is all about. There's going to be parts of the show that is going to have mystery to it. And you're going to have to come to some place inside your heart where you can go to bed that night, where you can just say, there are mysteries in our world that you don't know 100% how, why, where things happened, but you're going to have to be okay with that. Now, the thing that I would like to raise my eyebrow to is I am not in love with the super twang that the singer puts in this song. Paul and I both have had country music as a soundtrack to the background of our lives for many, many years. Everywhere you go, it's not uncommon for it to be playing in any store or in anyone's radio or whatever. Normal. It's a normal soundtrack to our lives. I can tell you, really honestly, she does not represent what a Texas accent sounds like. You guys can listen to it for yourself, but there are definite moments of twang. It's a very pretty voice. The problem is to me, is it sounds like it's from West Virginia or Arkansas or someplace else. That is a real twang. It's just not from around here.
No.
And so I appreciate that they were trying to make it sound Southern, but I think they hit another part of the country. Having said that, the visuals of showing individual photographs with a person who had been departed being just outlined and having stars or sky or something be filling up their space instead of their actual image was very touching. There was one of a mom and a child with their heads on the pillow, and you could see that the child was still there. The mom was just sort of like a starry sky kind of in her image outline. All of those things definitely hit my heart and really reminded me of how many people were gone, how many different walks of life were affected. And that just suddenly, you know, the guy you went fishing with or the person that you went to that party with or your child just left.
I'm going to cover the events of the prologue, and Caroline is going to hit what it actually means, because the prologue can be summed up in about four sentences. There's a group of primitive people sleeping around a campfire. A woman gets up, leaves a cave, and relieves her bladder outside. An earthquake happens that causes a cave-in. She tries to remove the rocks from the cave-in, but it turns out that she is pregnant, and the strain from moving the rocks has caused her to go into labor right there in graphic detail. She has the baby and doesn't know what to do for a couple of days, so she stays outside of the cave. The call of a predatory bird overhead draws her attention to a column of smoke off in the distance, and she decides to start heading that direction. She gets hungry, climbs up a tree to find a nest full of eggs. She's left the baby on the ground, where she hears a snake's rattle, and she looks down to find that the baby is up close and personal with a rattlesnake. She climbs down to save the baby, but before she can smash the snake's head in, the snake does bite her. She continues on her way toward the smoke, carrying the baby, but her health is degrading fast. She gets as close as she can, but she does die. The baby's cries summon another woman who comes and picks up the baby, and we assume everything turns out great after that.
When the woman comes out of the cave, she is going to the restroom, and right when she gets knocked over, we screenshot, there's this really strange, weird green glow.
You can only see it for a frame or two.
It's crazy. We'll put it up on our website. We'll Instagram it. It definitely gives you this feeling right away, like something supernatural is happening.
Very.
It is an earthquake, we think, but also could it have been the landing of an alien ship? Could it have been some sort of strike of something? I don't know. I have no idea. But it definitely, the green glow happening around her seemed
up in the sky.
Very odd, right?
Yeah.
So then after she's moving her rocks and she
and not goes, like Aurora Borealis. It was like something.
It was like neon green, else. Glowy. It was like toxic-y looking.
We'll show you a picture, but it's not going to be easy to see. The only thing that you're going to be able to tell is that green doesn't go in the sky. And that's what you're going to be able to tell there.
As she is moving the rocks and she goes into labor, the birth scene is jarring for several reasons. One, it's graphic. I mean, we're seeing a woman screaming and obviously in pain and
giving birth all by herself.
Certainly a nightmare for most people. They would not want to be in that position. But the music that they play over the top of this, so you don't hear her screaming, you just see her face, is a song that's called Prelude to Act One in La Traviata, which is Italian for The Fallen Woman. It's an opera.
The mood and tempo of the music does not really match the visual. So you're kind of, you have this idea because it's kind of poppy. It's like boom, 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 boom. You know, it's like.
We'll play you a little clip for you so that you can get an idea of what it sounds like.
It's almost whimsical in comparison to what you're seeing.
But given that it's called the Prelude to Act One, it gave weight to this idea that like, okay, this entire cave woman experience is really just setting the theme for the next season of The Leftovers. We were so thankful that Damon put out an actual article explaining that he was meaning for this section of the show to simply be setting the mood. This concept of being reborn, this concept of one mother passing away and passing the baby from one mother to an adoptive mother now.
He was essentially outlining to not get too tied up in this being connected to the show. That baby doesn't grow up to be Kevin or anything. This is just meant to be a thematic and mood setting standalone prologue.
So don't get caught up too much that this is a cave woman and like what a caveman days have to do with today's life.
I think there is one connection though, and that is what we see about the significance of the location.
Absolutely. I agree with that. So as that scene is concluding, the camera pans down her body and it goes into the water and we start hearing these joyful screams of girls swimming. And this is when we basically leave behind the setup of the season and move into modern day times.
Three girls. One has jumped into the water and she's enticing her friends to join her by swearing at them playfully and they're swearing back at her. And it's
love it because we say chicken shit. So that's all good.
They're just having fun. It's the sort of game where, oh, no, it's not cold. Come on in. Oh, yes, it is, in fact, very cold. And I've just gotten you to come into the very cold water.
What I noticed right away is that the cave woman in the previous scenes had been wearing sort of these like tied little cloths as like their clothing.
Loincloths.
Yeah, and then the girls were wearing these tied off bikinis that were in very much the same.
It's a sort of a visual connection,
right?
There.
It's their modern day loincloths.
Alongside the girls in this reservoir or quarry,
I think it's a spring.
Spring is a man wearing waders who is using some equipment to take samples of the water.
Yeah, his very elaborate equipment equals a plastic pitcher on a stick.
His name is Dr. Brian Goodhart.
And he appears to be Australian, right? Is that the accent you would say?
I would put it there, yeah.
So the one character starts talking to him and is definitely channeling her inner Amy and is teasing this 30-year-old man like, oh, is it going to mess up your measurements if I pee in the water over here?
He kind of makes a face back like...
like gross.
Please don't pee in the water.
And like you're kind of flirting with me all at the same time. The music that's playing in the background is called No Worry by Justine Skye, and it's on an album called Emotionally Unavailable. And it flows nicely into a second song called Loco Ono by Bass Nectar. And that album is called Noise Versus Beauty.
As usual, the musical selections we don't think are left to chance.
Never. I think they're always very deliberate. So we're going to do what we can to tell you what the songs are so you can listen to them for yourselves. And if you didn't catch them during watching, you can always listen to them on iTunes and get a sense of the mood. I took this as three silly girls having a good time. They kind of climb out of the water and they're kind of splashing and pushing and putting their clothes on and being rowdy and swearing at one another and being all kind of kooky and everything. It looked very much like what I remember being about 16 years old, 15, 16. The interesting thing of the way that scene concludes is that all three girls are in the car and now it is completely and totally silent. And the camera stays on them in the car driving like that for several seconds longer than need be, to the point where my eyes were like straining to look at each of their faces to be like, is something happening that I'm missing?
It was sort of like a Body Snatchers sort of thing.
Yeah, because
the music
like just,
was turned off and
they were just staring
straight ahead and just
not really
moving as little as possible. No distractions, no nothing. They were just sitting like drones.
Yeah, it was weird. I mean, it definitely was the type of thing that you had watched this entire cave woman scene. We've now transitioned into these girls laughing and being loud and having fun, and it was crazy. And then now it was like, and now a moment of silence.
Before they climb in the car, the character that was flirting with the doctor made a point to go back and get a bottle full of the spring water right underneath a gigantic public warning sign that says, do not take any water.
So again, like, look at her being like such a crazy teen, just taking water from a well here, from a spring, I should say.
So the next scene shows the girls getting to a home where they are back to normal, at least where other people can see them, right? So like alone, they act like drones. But then once someone else can see them, Michael, the brother, the music is playing, they're laughing again, and the girl gets out of the car and implies that the brother has waited around on the steps for her. I got the idea to see the friends.
Oh.
Because okay. She says something along the lines of, how long you've been waiting there?
Like, that's funny. I thought he was, I didn't know what he was waiting for, but I agree with you. It definitely seemed like he was waiting around. But I'm with you. Like, brothers are all about
girls.
Yeah, girls. Yeah, waiting to see the girls at drop off.
They are instantly, you can tell that they are way different in personality.
Yeah, the brother and sister. Yeah, absolutely. He seems like he's the type of person who is a little bit more sensitive and kind. And she's a little bit more rules.
He seems like rules guy.
Yeah, I agree with you. And then she is a little bit more silly and just antic-y and ready with a witty joke and a witty comment, but also going to push the envelope a little bit.
We come in, we find a family getting ready for the day, making breakfast.
Mom's got music playing in the kitchen, and we have Regina King playing mom. She is Erica Murphy, and she is a fun mom. I liked her. I liked how she was like, hello, guys. She's all asking them, how was the sleepover? Which that actually made me think, you know, that moment when they're in the car and they're just kind of staring. It made me think of like post-sleepover. Paul, you may not know this, but when you're having an all-girls sleepover, you don't tend to have any sleep.
I've only been to a few of those.
Yeah, I'm so sure. And so what ends up happening is the next day you do have these moments where you're just kind of like so tired. You're just kind of like, not even paying any attention. You're just kind of quiet and sitting there. And so it made me think of in the car of like, it's like, okay, they stayed up all night. Then they're antiquing around in this spring. And then they're just sort of like, you know, it's like when a toddler gets to the point of like being overtired, they're just like,
There was like something more ominous about their behavior than that.
I'm with you, but I'm just saying. So she was asking about, you know, did they get any sleep? And
did you take your meds?
So Evie at first kind of lies and says like, oh, no, yeah, no, like whatever. And then mom gives a second look and she's like, sorry. And she gets her meds out and takes it.
She asks about his dad up and she hands the container of water that she took from the spring over to her brother.
Who we learn's name is Michael, and he is getting out a test tube rack.
Or vials or something.
They look like test tubes to me. Yeah. And so he has them there on the kitchen shelf there as if he uses them all the time. He begins filling up the test tubes with the water that she brought from the spring.
Now we go and we meet John Murphy, who is still asleep in bed.
Mom, Erica, and both kids troop into his bedroom, and he does not stir at all.
The family tries to wake up Dad by playing some kind of stacking block game. If you look, the first two blocks that they put on his chest are books about Lenin and Mandela. Leaders on kind of different ends of the spectrum, I guess, in terms of like how they're regarded these days.
Yeah,
but interesting that he's reading books about leaders.
And that they're just picking up these books around their around the bedroom. So it's sort of like, wow, that's your like light bedtime nanai reading. Like,
right. Three inch thick books.
That's some heavy stuff. So they place these volumes on his chest. Now, we have had an entire season of watching the main character, Dad, having such an amazingly difficult time ever getting to sleep. Sleep time is always so fretful and so, I mean, he's always sweating. Everything is always swirling around. So to see the dad of any family here just sleeping so deeply.
Just sawing logs.
Yeah,
carefree.
That they could just stack up an entire tower.
Probably,
I mean,
a foot and a half, 2 foot worth of.
Yeah, I mean, they put the alarm clock on the top, like stuff. Cherry on the top of this of the sundae there. And he finally jerks awake.
John joins the family at the table for breakfast. He is super interested in everyone else's bacon. He can't seem to have enough bacon.
I was super into the way that John talks. I wrote down right away, I like how John talks. Like, he asks the kids, he's like, are you guys done with your bacon? And the kids are like, I don't know. Michael doesn't really know. And he's like, what are the factors influencing your decision about eating the bacon? I love people who talk like that. So I am instantly drawn into John. No matter how he is as a character, I am loving the way that he delivers his information.
They're just chewing on different family stuff, who's doing what, and then all of a sudden a chirp, a cricket chirp, stops everything.
And you can tell instantly that this is
an ongoing,
like, long-term family joke about, like, the cricket in the house.
John tries to find it, and everyone is trying to give him ideas of where it might be.
But like, laughing. Like, oh, like, you're never going to find it. Like, clearly this has been something that's been going on for a long time. No, I did look up about crickets, and there's lots of different
superstitions, you said.
There are superstitions in every walk of life and different religion. Different parts of the world having to do with crickets. It's very, very layered. But there are some sides that say that crickets in your home are a sign of good luck and you should never kill them. Don't even bother capturing them or anything like that. You just let it be. It's a sign of good luck. Then there's this entire other school of thought where if a cricket is in your home or you hear it chirping, two things. One, that it can be a forewarning that someone in your family is going to die. And secondly, that at nighttime when the person is sleeping, your soul in the form of a cricket comes out of your nose and is around, like basically like hops around the house, right? So there are these two very different sort of feels. One of this sort of like they represent the soul or in any way death coming to get you. And then on the other side, this very happy, a cricket on your hearth is good luck. Wealth is coming your way, good fortune, all this other thing. So right away, I'm super interested to figure out, can it mean different things for members of the Murphy family, or is this directed at one person? I would definitely say that if everyone in the household, Dad, is most definitely most tuned in and concerned about this cricket.
Oh, for sure. The rest think of it as some sort of joke, whereas John, he is facing this as if it is a home intruder, like an unwelcome
guest. Well, and that it's annoying and it must be found. And the rest of the people are kind of like, let it be, whatever.
Everyone sets off to their daily tasks. Michael sets off on his bike. He's got his test tube collection, and he is making his way down the street. He passes a few interesting things. One of them is a marker on the ground, number 7, and it is pointing to a glass box enclosing a gigantic rip in the street. It is not like a tree branch has grown underneath the street and is just kind of bumping it out of shape. It is like something has found a weak spot in the ground and pushed out in a major way.
And this is super interesting because we've all seen pictures of earthquakes or breaks in a road. And most of the time what happens is that it actually caves in. So most of the time when you see something, it ends up being some sort of pocket underneath a home or a structure or something where there's a sinkhole, basically. Okay. So like a sinkhole in a street or something, and everything falls into it. But in this case, what's interesting about it, how Paul's describing it, made us remember back to the manhole in season 1 where
like a buildup of pressure.
And it like pushed up. So it's the ground is pushing up and the road is like ripping apart upwards. One of the things that we wanted to make note is that this marker 7 is represented on a map of Miracle, which is going to be the national park that this town of Jardin is inside of. On our dailyreview.com website, we will put the map. We got to take a picture of the map. And so you can get an idea that it's sort of like the tourist map when you come into any amusement park or theme place or whatever, where they say like, you know, at marker 1, you'll see blah, 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 blah. Now, unfortunately, on this map, there is not
a lot of detail.
Well, there isn't a like
a key or a legend or a description.
Right. But each part of the town is marked with like a number and a marker. So you can take a look and see like what other areas maybe were highlighted on the map. So get over there and take a look at it.
So where he is going first, I think, is where the title of this episode might come into play. The title of this episode was Axis Mundi. M-U-N-D-I, and that has a few definitions, the main one being the world's point of beginning. That can be represented by a few things, and one of those few things is a man-made tower, such as the point where Michael is riding his bike.
There's a guy up in the tower, and it turns out to be old Turk Pipkin. He's playing a character who at this point we don't have a name for.
No.
But he lets down a bucket and Michael has thoughtfully packed up the leftover breakfast and is sending up some bacon and eggs for him. He lets down an envelope that is listed David Burton, Sydney, Australia. Because I'm constantly going to keep looking stuff up for you guys, I looked up. There was a couple different things that was available with this name and this location. We had two different ones. So David Burton, Sydney, Australia, in the Australian Dictionary of Biographies. It didn't have a birth date, but the death date was 1792. And David Burton was a botanist, a surveyor, and a pro gardener, professional gardener. He was the guy that you went to if you wanted to give a sample of the ground, the soil, and he would let you know whether or not this land was good or bad. So in one way, that was intriguing. It was like, okay, you know, if there was such a character that had such a background in Sydney, Australia, current, modern day, it's like, it made me feel like the tower man could be like sending some soil sample or something to him, as we had seen the man in the spring collecting water. That was the first one. The second thing that I found was a paranormal movie by Peter Weir called The Last Wave. In 1977. And in that one, the character's name was David Burton, and he was a lawyer. He was defending an Aborigine tribe against a murder charge. The information that I found was in a book called The Dark Side of ESP. We had thought a lot about that in previous seasons about whether the guilty remnant had any kind of ESP powers. And just generally speaking, the idea of this paranormal experience. And it turns out that over and over, it kept using a word that Paul recognized Damon and Carlton to be using a ton in podcasts about Lost,
which was prescience. Prescience is the foreknowledge of an event, or clairvoyance, or seeing the future, basically.
Or even feeling the future, right? That was kind of like a big deal. So in the story, The Last Wave, David Burton keeps feeling like there's going to be this wave that is going to take over and basically drown the city. And so it made, again, sort of this idea of being able to feel the future or whatever. So whether our tower guy was in any way referring to either David Burton, we felt like, wow, okay, either of those guys in a modern day setting could be an interesting person to send it to. Now, in either case, I feel like the tower man, he definitely is dressed like a Moses type character. He's got a long,
spooky beard.
He's wearing a robe. So could he be addressing a letter to a man who died in 1792? Absolutely. That seems right up his
alley. Or a movie character.
Or a character from a movie that he thought like could help out. Absolutely. Either which way, whether Damon and Tom Parada were picking up different ideas from either the movie or this historical character, either one was pretty interesting to us.
In the background of this exchange, there are a number of park rangers and cops directing traffic, using megaphones, instructing everybody that the tourists are about to arrive and you need to have your vendor stations all set up and ready to go because it's about go time, people.
They're selling souvenir type things.
And we get a chance to see a few things as Michael makes his way to his cart. I think he said it was 121.
Yeah, so it turns out that Michael has his own little vendor booth. He is the type of boy who would like wake up early in the morning. He didn't have a sleepover and whatnot. No, he's preparing his little booth for sale the next day.
There are people selling miracle t-shirts and miracle maps. And one man has what he calls miracle tobacco, which I would imagine that if I was him, I'd be selling it as tobacco that doesn't hurt you.
We're such babies. I think that could also just be weed, Paul.
Oh, all right.
Might just be a little marijuana.
All right. I guess things have lightened up in the
I have no idea. I'm just saying that you know, miracle tobacco could be a bunch of different things.
Michael sets up his table. He pulls out a number of little
accessories,
crosses, and his vials and pamphlets.
Church of where to go to church pamphlets. As he's doing this, there is a shaking of the earth that happens while he is setting it up. And it's very apparent because he's got these very fragile test tubes that he is worried about. And the elderly man who's selling the tobacco says, effing frackers. And then he looks at Michael and says, well, it adds to the mystique of our town.
There have been tremors attributed to fracking. Mainly because...
Paul, what is fracking as an oil and gas guy? Can you explain for a minute?
Okay. Well, fracking is the idea of pumping liquid, whether water or some other kind of fluid, into what was once considered a spent or used up drilling formation to try to compress it, to try to get whatever was remaining that they couldn't get the first time when they drilled it. They're going to try to get it again using this method where they're pumping something into the existing formation.
And so that can cause some tremor type activity around the area?
It has been attributed to that recently.
Okay, so that's kind of a modern
Important to know is that the fault lines in Texas aren't considered volatile enough to cause earthquakes on their own.
Right.
And so we don't have earthquakes here.
Right. We have hurricanes and that's like a common thing for us. But here, we've lived here most of our lives. I've lived here all of my lives except for a couple of years. And we do not have earthquakes. So the idea that this is happening, if you're watching and you're out in California or you're somewhere else and you're thinking like, well, you know, a slight little tremor might not be so uncommon or something. Nope. If we felt that, we would have gathered our vials and run home and cried to our moms. So the fact that they're all handling it very cool and calm lets you know that this is not normal for Texas. This is something strange.
Of the people getting off of these green school buses that are tour buses, there is a wide slice of life. There are everyday looking people, there are people in religious garb, and there are a number of disabled looking people.
And I would definitely say that it represents a lot of different walks of life. There definitely seem to be some Jewish men. We saw nuns. There was a woman who appeared to be blind. She had a cane. These people seem to be getting off someplace that they think holds some sort of special powers, or they're hoping to be blessed, or they're hoping to be healed.
And for those of us that didn't get that read off of that, there's an exchange between Michael and a German couple that really cements it. They are asking him, if we buy your vials
of water,
will we be protected? You can take that to mean from another departure, from anything. And Michael,
I appreciated Michael here.
Michael is like I said,
he's an honest guy.
He's a rule follower. He will not upsell this stuff. He says these are just souvenirs.
He even has like a little moment where he's kind of, I feel like a little sad for them, where he's kind of like, you guys, I hope you didn't come here expecting that I would give you a vial of water that's going to cure your life. Like,
he's, I think, like, they did, because they blow him off.
But
huge.
I love his face, though, because he's like, oh, man. Rule follower is one word, but I'm going to say he's a good heart. He's an honest heart. There's no rule that you can't upsell at a farmer's market, but he's just a good heart. He's not going to lie, and he's not going to make them believe something that isn't true or that he doesn't feel is true. We have no idea what this water is all about. I don't know. He also didn't just get it out of the tap. So that's one thing that I'm going to say is like a little interesting. Mm. He could have simply filled up those waters from in the bathtub or at the kitchen sink.
Right. It would have come from Jarden, right?
Yeah. And that's it. So the fact that he did bother to get the authentic water from the spring, to me, says that maybe some little part of his heart thinks that there's at least something a little bit special about that, whether healing or not. Certainly he doesn't speak to that, but special or unique, I will say that. We get to see what the other Murphys are up to, how they start their day, and we see John is going to go visit a friend, Isaac.
Isaac lives in a blue house with a number of golf carts parked outside. This is a pretty unusual thing.
That is a weird thing. Why do you think, I'm kind of interested in why so many people in town use golf carts. What's that about?
We live in a community with a golf course, so it's not too unusual to see golf carts.
An occasional one, yeah, for sure.
But this is a country town, and that is not, we've driven through a lot of country towns in our time here in Texas, and that is not a typical way of getting around town.
Do you think it's something like when the tourists get off the school bus, do you think maybe they can like check out a golf cart or something to tool around town? It kind of makes sense, I guess.
In the sense that if Jarden was just a national park, maybe. But Jarden is a functioning town, so I just don't see it. But they are there, so people are using them. It's just kind of weird and funny to point out that this yard is like a parking lot for golf carts.
I do think that this is my guess. My guess is like you hop off the tourist bus, you're given your map, and then either you're given access to or you like check out a little golf cart. And then you treat it just like as like if you were like in Animal Kingdom or something, and you're like riding the tram around and they're pointing out stuff. Like it feels like it's like a self-guided tour. So Isaac appears to be one of the tour spots.
I'm not going to spoil anything. I'm just going to tell you how I felt watching the scene cold the first time I saw it. I don't know John Murphy. I don't know his story arc, but I did get this weird, ominous feeling about the guy. Caroline hasn't watched The Sopranos, so she doesn't know what I'm going to say exactly, but this scene reminded me of watching a scene with Tony Soprano. In that he was dealing with a person who wanted to defer every amount of respect he could to this other man, in this case, John Murphy, but out of this place of like fear that he didn't know what was going to happen if he didn't. John comes in and he says something about that he's heard that there's going to be renters, and they discuss fire code issues related to taking on renters. Okay, that's kind of interesting, but that's not really why he's here. He wants to know about the readings that Isaac is giving people.
So there's a whole slew of handprints that are up tacked on the wall. And it looks very much like a preschool kind of art project. Like everybody did a little handprint.
Like they're getting ready for turkey drawings for Thanksgiving.
They're going to turn it into a little gobbler. John says, I would like a reading. And Isaac is nervous. He
palpably nervous, like, yeah, almost shaking, like, oh geez,
I kind of knew
it would come to this, or
something. Or like you don't want to get John's attention. You just really don't want to be in the spotlight with him. So John's not acting mean or.
No, he doesn't say anything through this whole process.
He doesn't say anything, but you're right. It's his mere presence. that is creating a bit of an uncomfortable feeling for Isaac. So I love that Isaac has this process down to a science, because
an assembly line.
Yeah, he just squeezes out the little paint onto the like the cookie tray, and he's like, all right, you're going to want to smear the paint around and then press it hard over here. And John gives his handprint, and then Isaac's all, here's a wet nap, and he blows dry it with a hair dryer and everything. And even you can tell on John's face, he's like a little amused by how much this seems like he's like a small child doing a project.
He even has like an X-ray light box up on the wall where he puts the handprint for his reading.
He puts his little glasses on too, like he's like, let me see exactly where the fracture could be.
He catches John off guard by saying, you have a birthday coming up? And John says, yeah, it's the day after tomorrow. That does seem to take him off guard. Isaac pauses and then turns off the light, and
he's like, never mind.
He obviously lies and says, yeah, I'm not getting anything.
And John presses him and says, you know, tell me what you see. And he says, well, something bad is going to happen. And again, the way that John phrases this is just why John's a cool character.
Well, that is not ideal.
I like the way he talks. It's cool. Now we press on into this idea that John is calling him out on this. He says, you know, we've known each other since third grade, and you've never mentioned to me that you have this superpower, this magical power, whatever this is. And in the background, the music is starting, and it's this like...
Music is a strong word. It's more like...
It's like a beat, I guess I want to say, right?
It's a building of intensity through various sound effects and things. It's, you know, it's yeah. A very deep drone building.
For me,
thundery.
Though, every time I hear it, it makes my heart start like beating faster. Like it's your cue as the watcher, like, this is getting more intense. And like, this is what it's all about. What's happening here?
John wants to know, is this real? Tell me the truth. Is this real? And Isaac says, this is real.
Which totally, oh my gosh, did you not have a flashback to season one and the idea of like, is this real?
Yeah, yeah.
Reminded me of Holy Wayne and hugs and is this real? And
I am of the opinion that the sudden departure is not the only supernatural thing that we are going to run into in this show. So can this guy in this little blue house with the golf cart parking lot have psychic abilities in this world? Yes, I think he can.
Well, it reminded me of season one and the idea of the congressman asking Tom, is this real? And Tom saying, you know, this is as real as it gets, you know. Isaac almost says it verbatim. He's like, this is as real as this is going to get, you know.
Well, that's almost a mirror in timing from...
Oh, it is. You're right.
One episode to the other, you know, episode to episode. Almost.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
John says, well, I got to respect that. How much do I owe you? And he drops just a random amount of money, $60, even though Isaac had charged the customer beforehand $140. And John takes off. Isaac is sweating bullets.
Oh my gosh, so stressed out.
The next scene is a one-off that is just a quick choir session with Evie and friends in the high school gym, which is where no choir ever would practice.
At least not here, right? In Texas, that would be pretty unusual. We pretty much have choir rooms and such. So it's kind of weird that they're, even in this small town, that they'd be practicing in the gym. It's a little unusual.
What the whole scene is to show us that Jarden has bought in to this idea that they are special. They've changed their school song to reflect their uniqueness in the world post-departure.
And that they are all so blessed to
and
be...
And chosen,
right. And so the words of the song you should listen to when you're watching, and they very much reflect the attitude of the town.
Now comes for some weird stuff.
Right? We flash to the woods and... Instantly, I remember this is HBO because these girls who, again, we've described as being sort of 15, 16, we know at least one can drive. They are completely naked, and it's the same group. It's Evie and her two pals that have been swimming, and they are running through the woods. And
they are completely naked.
The camera keeps zooming in sort of on different parts of their bodies.
The nakedest parts.
The parts where their bathing suits usually touch. The thing that Paul and I kept trying to do is really look at their faces to try to figure out, are they running scared? are they laughing?
This isn't some streaking joke. They have faces that are emotionless. They are running pretty hard.
They're running, yeah, very fast, which they appear to be barefoot. So, I mean, God, I'm clearly such a baby. I would be so afraid I would step on something. I'd be like prancing unless I was running from something in a pretty serious way.
But still, they are emotionless, except for right at the end. The scene is maybe 10 or 15 seconds long, and it ends with Evie. She appears to be picking up speed, and the only emotion you get from her is that she is actually trying harder to move a little faster. But it's just the slightest indication, and she raises her hand up,
both arms up,
as if she was at the end of a race. But you don't get that finishing line sense, because the scene cuts off with that same building, intensifying sound that Caroline was describing earlier.
Right, that ominous sound. So it flashes right from her running to the sound of a ball smacking into a catcher's mitt. And we are in the Murphy's yard. John is playing catch with Evie. Evie is a pitcher, appears to be a fast pitch softball, and she is winding up for pitches, and they show her building again in intensity. At first, the ball is hitting, you know, with pretty good speed, but as she goes, the last couple of pitches, she's smacking. Her dad has to take his glove off and shake off the pain of the pitch.
A lot of people probably have never seen fast pitch softball pitching in real life.
So it's like a windmill style. I recognized it right away as a old school softball player. And so as soon as she was winding up, that's absolutely what girls here in Texas would be doing.
She takes a break, tells a knock-knock joke, and I have to wonder if this is Damon doing what Damon does, which is talking directly to the audience, because she tells the joke about a broken pencil. It's a knock-knock joke, and the punchline is, it's pointless. And what is Damon telling us? Is it the last scene about the running girls? Was that pointless? Was something else pointless? Is life pointless? Who knows? What is Damon trying to tell us?
Huh. Yeah, I have no idea. That's interesting. But John appreciates Evie's wit, and clearly telling jokes is part of their family language. How they get along with one another is clearly through sarcasm and jokes.
Well, I think that he can appreciate that it's a reflection on himself, maybe, that she can move from the intensity of flinging a ball. I mean, that a fast pitch softball can get up to, like, I don't know, 80 miles per hour or something like that. So she was winging it like that, hurting his hand, and then boom, switch to telling a knock-knock
joke.
Just
being silly like a little kid.
That's an emotional kind of shift. You have to build yourself up to be able to throw a ball super hard. And then a knock-knock joke is the next thing you follow it up with.
I love it. She's gotten to the point that when she throws to her dad, she's hurting him. And so that's a very sort of like...
It's a milestone.
It's
a rite of passage.
It is actually. And then on the flip, here she is kind of being like a elementary school kiddo telling a silly little joke. So I think that works perfectly. The way that they dress Evie, her glasses, her hair, they definitely are trying to play this game of like, how old is she? And is she's like a little younger? She dresses a little younger. Her hair and glasses are definitely a little bit younger than how she can behave. She talks a little bit older, hotter talk than she appears. Certainly the swearing but also just like her actions. They have a lot of independence in the town. She's able to go out with friends and stay out late and all that kind of stuff.
The next scene takes place at night. Shows a group of very hard looking men getting ready to go to work at the firehouse.
They are saying numbers out loud. So one's saying two, two and a half, three.
John says five. And the other men are like, geez, John, five?
Yeah, they all turn to look at him like, whoa, that's serious. And he says, you know, he's lying to people and he's taking their money. It's a five. Paul and I had differing opinions on this.
I thought it was a grading system that they were using to measure either their... what they thought the seriousness of this whatever, it turns out to be their own kind of moral judgment.
Isaac's crime.
Right.
The grading of Isaac's crime.
According to their own internal scale of rightness.
And then on my flip side, as soon as I see them, you know, putting fireman suspenders on their shoulders and I hear two, three, five, I'm thinking, alarm fire. So they're thinking, is this a 2-alarm fire, 3-alarm fire, 5-alarm fire? So instantly I'm thinking, oh my God, they're going to set a fire. Now, this is obviously unnerving for any of us because we're not accustomed to firefighters behaving like that. They, like the police, are supposed to be in this role of protecting us. So not unlike previous season 1, where the police can be maybe somebody you need to be a little bit scared of.
In this town, it's the firefighters.
Yeah, apparently it
is. Taking a page out of Fahrenheit 451, the firefighters roll up to Isaac's house, kick in the door, instruct him to get out, and John immediately starts giving directions on what to do to the other firefighters to make the house look like it burned down on its own.
So they say it's a gas stove in the kitchen, like go light her up, basically.
Isaac is not interested in going willingly.
Well, he's like, brother, don't do this. This is the thing that shocked me, I guess. He doesn't say, what are you guys doing here? What is this? What's happening? He's not like that. He's not like, I'm shocked, surprised, and uninformed about what this situation is. He's like, don't do this. He knows from the second they kick in the door that they're going to burn his house down, which means this ain't the first rodeo.
They bully him into admitting he is selling a lie, although he said that under duress. And he says, okay, I'm not leaving. You know, yeah, F no, you guys, I'm not leaving.
He stands his ground and he's like, this is my house. I have every right to be here. And the next scene is him being launched through the window, the front glass. So they don't show it, but clearly a couple of the firemen just pick him up and toss him out the front window, which I do have to say, although, yes, of course, he'd be hurt there. I am pleasantly surprised that they were not willing to burn a man to death. That is a yay.
They drag him away and basically watch his house burn. They are dressed and ready to fight a fire, but they are not there to fight. I think they're there to stop the fire from getting to anybody else's house.
Yeah, I think, yeah, they are. They're just on like that perimeter sort of patrol. The thing that, of course, catches your eye is John striding to the fire truck and putting on his hat. And as he pulls down the shield, it reveals he's the captain.
And you can see the fire in the reflection of the shield.
He is the Tony Soprano of the firehouse. And if keeping you safe is the currency of the town, basically, then he is the head honcho, because this is one way to get you. One of the things that it made me think of right away also is throughout season 1, the concept of the GR smoking and fire in general comes into play a lot of times. They bring it up so many times.
The Jameson parents died in a fire.
Patty describes it to Lori that the fire is going to burn her up. That
fire's guilt, a powerful image.
Yeah, and that guilt and doubt is represented as fire within someone, and that it could burn you up internally, symbolically. There's just a lot of times that fire, the concept of fire, or in any way, who controls the fire, or controlling your own fire, is a big, big, big symbol throughout season 1. And so I thought the idea of making him a firefighter in this one is interesting, because we kind of found that the laws of the land
didn't do any good.
Well, it didn't matter anymore, no. Right? That people had their own compass now that really, it just didn't answer to the law of Congress and your state legislators and whatnot. And in fact, those people had no power anymore. They weren't making laws or worrying about stuff. They were really having a hard time in any way controlling the crowds or the people or population generally. So the idea of switching over to firefighters and the idea of your physical safety in right. a whole different way, becoming
the lowest
power,
level on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right,
is
shelter, right?
Right.
Whereas,
so if we can take you,
security's higher. That's where the cops come in. This,
right.
This is lower.
So
this
if
space.
We can burn down your shelter, you are a man without a home, literally, right? And so the idea that within this place, we come to learn that having a residence in this town is a big deal. And so if your residence is taken from you, what then? Like, I don't even know if this, if Isaac's allowed to stay in this town if he doesn't have a house to live in.
In the next scene, in the ER, Isaac starts to address that idea.
Absolutely. And so we see that Erica is a doctor, it turns out. I wasn't sure if she was a nurse or a doctor because she's dressed in
scrubs,
but not a white coat. So I wasn't 100% sure if she was the nurse or the doctor. But I watched a little clip on HBO Meet the Murphys, and they say she's a doctor.
And she's picking little tiny shards of glass out of Isaac's face.
Yeah. And so, that means that he broke that window with his face.
And he tells her, I was born here. I belong here.
And I have a right to be here.
Right. Things like that. Erica.
In true soprano style, clearly she knows her husband did this. And there's no...
She doesn't want to know the details, but she is not going to back up and say anything like, oh my God, what did my husband do? She's just like...
If you truly were a psychic, you would have seen this coming. That's what she tells him. She doesn't seem to be ruffled by the idea that her husband would have been involved in this in any way. She behaves as if this is justified and this makes complete sense. So to me, this was every indicator that although Isaac says, how long has your husband been burning people's houses down? She says, you know, just tonight, like as if this was the first time, we as viewers can pick up all the context clues that there is no way that this is the first time that they have done this. So I don't know if she's actually covering or is this the first time she is aware, but she's awfully calm about this in a way that makes me feel like there's no way that this is the first time she has been fixing somebody up.
Before we move out of this scene, I wanted to make sure that we hit something that you caught back in Isaac's house.
Yes.
Isaac is pleading ignorance. I don't understand. And John says, oh, you understand.
Yeah, man, that was like verbatim of Patty and Kevin's conversation.
In the cabin.
Right. And it being, you know, where in this case, John was Patty and Kevin was Isaac. And it was that scene basically where she's saying, you know exactly what's going on here. And him saying, no, I don't understand. And she's saying, no, you understand. Like, you get this. You know exactly why this is happening to you. And yeah, wow, that was like, screenshot, like exactly back to that scene is like, oh man, okay, every theme, every strand is continuing through. We're just in a different place. Our story continues the following morning with Erica waking up, and the visual is really interesting because it's a little bit blurry all around her. And as she's reaching for the nightstand, you hear a squealing sound, and we realize that Erica is putting in her hearing aids. And as her hearing aids are getting into place in her ear, the environment starts to come into focus. I thought this was a really great effect. I thought that it showed how as her hearing sort of turned on, the environment around her turned into focus. And that was a really cool visual effect. I also really appreciated the small details, like that the hearing aids were squealing as she was putting them into her ears. Having a kiddo who wears hearing aids, that's totally accurate. They make that sound, and it's cool for them to keep to those small details.
I had thought that I had noticed hearing aids in her ears, you know, as a parent of a special needs child, that is one of those things you kind of key into, like, is my slice of the pie being represented here or what? I'm not sure. But yeah, then they showed her putting them in, and they do make that it's a feedback sound, and it was like the same pitch that we're familiar with.
Yeah, very familiar with. I also really appreciated, too, that here they were representing a hearing impaired individual who is a doctor and a successful mom, and, you know, everything about her is completely typical, and it just happens to be that she has hearing loss. I'm also super curious, how is that going to play into their story?
From a storytelling standpoint, why would you just throw that in?
It just seems like it's something interesting, like this is going to come into play. She heads out on her run through the community. And so this is a little trade-off for all of us who enjoyed Justin Theroux runs. We now have a Regina King run, far less gratuitous.
Right. She kept her business strapped in.
So she is running along and she runs into the woods, where she goes straight for the base of a tree where there is a gardening tool there, and she gets right busy to work. She starts scraping the dirt away She unearths a shoebox that has what appears to be like a rubber band wrapped around it. As she is taking the rubber band off, she kind of pauses and closes her eyes and kind of has a moment. It appears perhaps to be prayer, or at least like a moment of like thought. And as she takes the rubber band off and takes the lid off, there is a live bird in there who is appearing to be in good health and is just kind of looking at her, and the bird flies away. Paul and I look at each other like, what? This was a terrible place to keep your bird, Erica. We do not put them in boxes and, you know, put a rubber band around it and bury them. So now we're wondering two things. One, did she put the bird in live and she came back to see if it was still living? That's bizarre. Or is there any chance that she put this bird in dead or injured, buried it, and then now it's alive?
And we have a pet cemetery type situation.
Now, certainly the ground and water and the town itself has been sort of deemed this special magical place. So could it be possible? I guess so. It has a chance.
Well, we definitely have a mystery to look for now.
I would say, though, here's the thing that catches me a lot, too. Erica's response is not one to say, oh, my God, I can't believe it worked. The bird's alive.
It is relieved.
It is relieved and happy. But she's like, okay, then, like, fly off, happy bird. But it's calm and cool in the same type of way that she kind of was with Isaac about the fire. Like, well, you know, that's the way it goes. It's like it's become so routine that this isn't even super magical anymore. And that makes you wonder, wow, how long has this been going on and what other magical things are out there?
We meet up with Erica again as she's on her way back into her house. And we find that John is focusing all of his senses, looking for the cricket. He's got his hands held out to either side, like, stop everything. I need to locate the cricket.
She's kind of giving him a little business, and he says that he's just awake to join them for church. And Erica's like, giving this kind of biz, like, oh, you got something to be guilty about? That's why you're heading to church? But again, in that kind of like funny little rapport that they have, she isn't really calling him out on having just burned down Isaac's house and, you know, having to clean up Isaac's face or anything. She's just like, yo, you know, burning down houses and throwing men through windows. Like, it's all very cash. So they head off to church,
where their son Michael is up on the pulpit giving a reading.
It's Thessalonians, and there is a
passage where he looks at his dad in the eyeball from across the church and says, no one repays evil to evil.
Now, this is one of those things that if you are taking it like he found his dad's eyes, I'm taking it like dad found Michael's eyes. So I was taking it like Michael was up there completely just doing his reading. He was looking around the church normally. He was reading at a very normal pace and tone, and his face did not seem like he was zeroing in on dad's eyes. But I do agree that completely John was doing like a frozen stare into Michael's eyes. It was clear to me that John was taking it like these words were 100% directed to go into his soul.
Sort of one of those things where, like, you don't notice something until you're paying attention to it kind of thing.
Oh, I was thinking that, like, when you're guilty of something, you think that every single sideward glance or everybody knows, and that everybody is judging you and that kind of stuff.
Michael finishes the reading, sits down, and the regular preacher gets up and tells the congregation that he's going to be gone for a while. He's having some kind of surgery, but he's got a replacement, and it's a familiar face.
This was kind of awesome. He says that he met him on a mission and that he is a great speaker for the Bible and the Lord. And guess who it is? Our good buddy, Matt Jameson. But this is the weird thing. Matt comes on up and he starts to be like, hey, everybody, thanks so much. When my wife, Mary, and I... Okay, now stop. This is when that weird sound effect starts coming in again. And it starts making that like that foreboding kind of noise. It's not exactly music, but it like gets your heart beating. So as Matt is saying, everybody said that my wife would never be able to... And then the preacher just says, "Thanks so much, Matt. Good to see you. We all know this is a special place." Completely pushes Matt like to the side. Matt's like, oh, well, like, thanks for having me. At this point, John looks over at those other two firefighters who had been a part of the big arson.
Isaac relocation project.
Exactly. And they all eye each other like, mm-hmm. Which, okay, what in the world? Why just Matt simply saying that this is a magical place, or that he sort of seemed to be implying that perhaps Mary had shown some signs of progress or improvement? It seems like these firefighters were like, we're not having any of that talk.
At the most cursory level here, Matt being a new guy, an outsider, is enough to get kind of this unofficial sheriff of Jardin's attention, it seems. There's probably something more to it, but at the very least, Matt has made the list of people that they're going to keep an eye on, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. So Calvin is the preacher, and as they finish up service, they're standing at the kind of receiving line that the preacher does at the end.
Thanks for coming to church. See you
right,
later.
Right. Thank you for coming. John comes over, and Calvin's like, oh, nice to see you. And John, because he's like a sass, is like, well, don't say it like I'm not here. You're like making me look bad.
You're going to make the new guy think I never come.
Right. And so he says hello to Matt, and he kind of crouches down and says hello to Mary. And then he looks Matt right in the eye and says, hey, it seems like you were about to say something up there before Calvin interrupted you. And Matt, I think, ever intuitive, reads the situation, and his face like really seems to rethink. Like, we all had the idea when he was on the altar that he was definitely going to speak to some sort of miracle phenomenon that was going on with Mary. But instead, he like dials it all back.
And
he's
just
like,
gives a pat response.
Yeah, he just says, well, we're just feeling very safe here. And, you know, I felt like a burden was lifted off my shoulders. And it really, to me in that moment, I felt proud of Matt for recognizing like, hey, you came up there with a lot of fervor. And the preacher kind of like gave all nonverbal signs that you need to rein it in and act a lot more cool about the powers of this place. And he did. Like he sized up, like Paul was explaining, that kind of Tony Soprano kind of like aura that John is putting off, and kind of was like, oh, sir, I just meant that this is a safe place and I'm happy to be here.
Well, John's demeanor when he asked Matt, it was casual, but it was also, I ask anybody, I want to ask anything I want to ask them.
It was pointed. Yeah, I agree. It was kind of like, yeah, it was in many ways reminiscent of old Kevin. And like, I'm just going to, like, there's not going to be an elephant in the room. I'm just going to say it. And it's going to be awkward and weird, but like, I'm just going to say it. So the next scene is the family at a like kind of hometown diner kind of place.
And hold on to your hats. This is a weird scene.
Well, first, John pulls his soprano card again and is kind of acting super controlling about his order with the waitress. Now, we've already seen them eat bacon and eggs at the house, and everything was fine with that. There was no special specific way to handle that. But now in the diner, he's all, you have to have the eggs separated on a different plate from the bacon.
He sends back his food so that they get it corrected. And apparently they mess it up all the time. And he keeps sending it back.
To me, again, this is just one of those, like, it reminded me of Sleeping with the Enemy. It reminded me of that. When he has all these rules, like the dish towels have to be a certain way and the labels have to be facing a certain way. He does not have to have his bacon separated from his eggs. But because he said it, it better be that way.
So you think he's kind of OCD, but
I don't know. OCD
worse.
Is too kind. OCD is too kind. There's plenty of people who are OCD and they don't mean to push that onto other people. This is like, I said jump, you say how high. And so to me, I was like, okay, like I'm starting to get a funnier read on John. He's a little bit different.
Going back to what Caroline and I were kind of disagreeing about a second ago, whether or not John was reading into this the reading selection or if Michael was kind of projecting it to John, John addresses it right now. And he says, what made you pick that reading?
See, and I love what Michael says. And I do believe that his ease of answer to his father is like, you know, the readings are predetermined anyway. He's not like, what do you mean, sir? What do you mean? Like, he's not caught up in any of that. He's just like, readings are predetermined. you know, that was the reading for this week. And John seems a little off, actually, like taken aback, where he's like, anyway, what is a Thessalonian? You know, and tries to
kind of play it cool.
Yeah, he does have to try to play it cool because honestly, Michael did not bite. He could have acted awkward about the fact that what he was saying, but he did not imply that he had been judging his dad or his actions through his reading in any way, really.
The usage of the word predetermined, though, seems loaded to me just because it would, you know, in this kind of show, predetermined, like by whom? Like,
oh, yeah. So like, he could have just said it's like on a calendar kind of thing, like not use that type of like premonition-y kind of word, but more like it's like destiny.
Things that are predetermined are divine in nature.
Oh, that's true. Ooh, that's true.
Not just like the secretary chose it that month.
Well, you know? I do think that it's like with the Catholic Church, I do think that's put out like a year at a time or something. What weeks are going to be what readings? I think it's like nationwide. You're going to get like the same reading on the same day.
This was not the Catholic Church.
No, it was Baptist. That's true. But I just, no, I'm with you 100%. I like that you picked up on the word predetermined, because that does definitely sound like destiny, fate. Like this is what was supposed to happen. You were supposed to hear those words. If you don't usually come to church and you happen to be there that day, oh, that was all on very much on purpose. So intrigue. I like that. I like it.
Now, sort of like how when, you know, someone has a kid that misbehaves and everyone else just kind of has to ignore it because it's like, well, you know, we just kind of deal with that problem, but we just don't pay any mind to it.
See, and I'm going to even throw you like an extra little weird. You know how like these days, like on Portlandia, there's like this one little skit where the person like is looking at a menu and they're like, now, do you know if these chickens were raised? Like, did they have friends? And blah, 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 like sort of in this ultra, ultra where does your food come from kind of move. This next move, Jerry the farmer comes in with a live goat and he like spreads out a plastic tarp on the floor.
Right next to our Murphy's booth.
And now everybody is going around and they're just kind of like, ugh. And the one waitress is like, Jerry, you got to do that right now. And he's like, just gets out a big old knife and slashes the goat's throat. Blood splatters everywhere.
Except not on the tarp too much.
Yeah, really. He doesn't do a good job of laying that out. Splatters everywhere. And he's like, his response is,
sorry folks.
And just pulls the tarp and the dead body back out. Now, here's the deal. When you look around the room, all the people who we would guess are the local townsfolk, they glance, like Paul's saying, that kid who's kind of misbehaving.
This is an annoyance, but totally happens all the time.
They're not wigged out at all. Not wigged out. So, like, that's why I was joking about, like, this is the source of your food. Like, they just, they have to show you, right? But the funniest thing that...
You think he's just the local kind-hearted goat butcher?
No, that's why I'm joking about, like, the Portlandia. Like, it's like where people are like, I'm curious how my food is made. Like, it's like, just like, I don't know, like, taking it to the craziest place. But, okay, here's the funny thing, though. I loved that the person in the booth next to them has their iPhone out. They're totally videotaping the goat thing. They're like taking pictures. That is dead on what would have been happening. Nobody intervenes. Nobody yells out or screams. They just are like uploading it to YouTube or whatever, you know,
right,
or Instagram, or they're tweeting about it or something. So to me, that gave like that one more little glimpse of like, this is fresh. This is new. This is current.
Speaking of current, I think this next tiny little piece is an acknowledgement to the audience that Damon and the writers wanted to go a little easier on the audience, maybe build an audience by having a little bit more comic relief in every episode instead of every several episodes.
Okay, so this is cracks me up funny. Okay, so in the previous season, there had been this very quiet but ongoing thread that the Perfect Strangers cast from the sitcom from Perfect Strangers was being watched in the background many times in the insane asylum with Chief Garvey. Amy was watching it in their living room. It kept getting brought up like over and over. And we had heard that the entire cast of Perfect Strangers had been part of The Departed. This seemed so silly and so ridiculous that they bothered to tell you, because there were many other celebrities that had been departed as well. The next scene we have is John eating some ice cream in their living room, and he's watching like kind of like a TMZ extra kind of show. And they have tracked down Mark Lynn Baker, who is cousin Larry from Perfect Strangers. And they say that they have tracked him down to a little town in Mexico where he had basically faked his own departure. This is all ridiculous.
And he's like, no Mark Esta. No Mark Esta.
And they're like, why'd you do it, Mark? Tell us, why'd you do it? He's like flipping over the table, running away from the camera.
It's pretty hilarious.
It was so funny and such like a funny way to take something that people were definitely paying attention to in season one, but like just made it all so ridiculous and hilarious. And again, what a nice comic relief to our previous slash the goat neck scene in the middle of a restaurant.
Except for Isaac, I don't think anyone cried this whole episode.
Whoa.
He had his house burned down, so that's okay.
And he got thrown to a window. I would cry more about glass in my face. I'm sad about my house, but I mean, I have glass that has to be picked out with tweezers out my face.
That was a big project.
Ouch. Okay, so since Paul and I have a child who uses sign language, this next little blip made me super interested what they were talking about. John is carrying his ice cream bowl to the kitchen, and as he does so, he passes by what appears to be the bedroom door of Evie.
I think so. Even though,
layout of the house-wise, I thought he was on the first floor.
In Texas, ooh, it's okay to have master bedrooms on the ground floor.
But they definitely, later in the episode, her bedroom is definitely upstairs.
That would be a pretty, yeah.
So maybe this is, I'm going to say perhaps this is a guest room. I don't know. But definitely Erica and Evie are sitting on
a bed,
and they're signing to one another.
Right.
So I watched it over and over again, and this is what it seems to be saying. So Evie seems to be signing the sign need or have to, like meaning something like I have to. And Erica is signing back, please don't get in trouble, please. Okay, what are they talking about? I'm super curious. Paul and I were trying to figure out, okay, are they speaking in sign because they don't want dad to hear? And does that imply that John does not sign? Which a hearing person married to someone who uses sign who does not learn to use sign.
It's kind of uncommon.
And questionable. I mean, yeah. Right? Like it's rude basically that they wouldn't have tried to learn anything.
What we've learned is that people that are hearing impaired, they wear their hearing aids to get along with others, but they look forward to that time when they can take them out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we can speak with our own child that there's an uncomfortable part to it that they can get sweaty, especially down here in Texas. It's humid.
If you don't know what they sound like, imagine just turning your phone up loud, and imagine that same quality of sound. Not your cell phone. I mean, like your house phone. Just turning that up loud, and that being what you hear. And just listening to that all day, is that perfect? No. You probably want to escape that.
Yeah. And you know, especially in the evening, like we said, at the end of a day, it is draining, is what has been told to us.
So then you bombarded would shift with this to your more universal language.
Which might be sign.
Automatically.
Right. And so again, I felt like the fact that they were talking in sign with the door open kind of meant like that they knew that they were safe to speak in sign and that John or whomever else wouldn't know what they were saying. No, he doesn't call him out on it, at least not at this point. He doesn't say like, hey, girls, what are you guys talking about or anything.
He just moves on.
He does. But this conversation of Evie seeming to sign that she has to do something and mom signing, don't get in trouble, please. Okay, what is this all about? I'm super curious.
He goes into the kitchen and tosses his bowl into the sink and the spoon pops out of the bowl and goes directly into the garbage disposal. The sound effect, the intensifying sound effect starts happening right away. But this, instead of anxiety building in someone around John, this is John's own anxiety building.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to get it out of there.
Well, Isaac's words, I think, are running through his head that something bad's going to happen to John. And so here it is. Like, are you going to stick your hand down into the garbage disposal?
He makes kind of a production out of it. If he was your kid, you'd be like, come on, just get it out of there.
I don't think he does not want to stick his hand in there, right? And so right when he's trying to reach in there, Michael steps up behind him, is like, hey, and it's that like moment where he jumps back and Michael's like, what's up? This is one of those things where like I did have to be a little like, okay, so if you're the dad and you think that there's some potential danger, he's like, oh, my spoon fell down in the drain. And he just lets his son like reach right over him and stick his hand down in there and get it out. I'm a little ick about it because obviously he had a very real fear that that garbage disposal was going to somehow turn on and chop up his hand. But like he doesn't say anything like, no, son, I got it. Or let's get like the tongs out for the barbecue and like go in there. Like he like completely is cool with Michael just jamming his hand down in there. I don't know. That felt a little like, ugh.
I think he knew that he was being silly, but it was one of those anxiety things where if you are anxious, you can't stop yourself from being silly. It's just nothing you can do about it.
So we see Michael is packing up some food from the fridge and John's like, other people feed him, you know, and Michael is wearing his safety patrol little crisscross.
The rule follower, Michael.
This crisscross little like nighttime reflector what do you call those things?
Like they look straps. Like suspenders.
They look like suspenders, yeah. He's like, you know, oh, he likes mom's cooking. And John's like, be safe. And then you hear the cricket like, do these little crickety sounds.
That distracts John and Michael slips out.
Yeah, but I also think it's like on the button. Like he's like, be safe. And then the cricket's like, crick. And you're like, trouble.
Michael takes the food to the guy in the tower, who asks him, rather than say thank you, he just says, did you mail my letter? And he says, yes, I did.
Which is still kind of hilarious to me because, again, remember, it just said, David Burton, Sydney, Australia.
Right.
So it really did make me wonder, do you think Michael did mail it? Or did he try to find the real address? Is this the way the world is now? You can just put someone's name and the general city and country and it gets there? What's the deal?
Given everything that Michael has done, I have no reason to doubt that Michael followed through.
And like put it in the mailbox. Do you think he like tried to finish out the address?
Yeah.
You do? So you think he like knew who that was supposed to go to?
I think he took a guess or found it somehow. I don't know exactly, but I do not doubt that that letter is in the mail headed for Australia.
Okay, go ahead.
He continues on his way where he comes across a place where some police are arresting a couple who are complaining about being basically harassed by the police.
It seems like these people have snuck in, and it's apparent as Michael's riding his bike that the town appears to actually be enclosed by
high chain link fence
with
like spotlights,
barbed wire and stuff,
and patrols.
So it looks like to keep people out. And I wouldn't have used the word police. I would have said park rangers.
Well, but these guys are tasing and
oh absolutely, they're responsible for keeping the park safe, don't get me wrong, but I'm interested so far again that there's been no police. And I think that that's interesting because otherwise, as Kevin comes into the picture here eventually, I am expecting that he needs to have a job. And so I'm kind of wondering, you know, where's our local police department? We haven't run into anyone yet.
That's
just
interesting.
These like park ranger types.
If it's completely a national park, then
I think that there are no police officers in a national park. There's park rangers.
I think you're probably right because it's like federal land. So what mm-hmm. would the local sheriff do?
I don't think that stuff exists anymore because, I mean, in our world, people don't live in a national park. So that doesn't make any sense. So this is a real anomaly. But what that does, though, again, like we were saying, is that it puts the fire department in a different place. Because, like, in our minds, I think most of the time you say police, fire, EMT, blah, 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 blah. But if there is no police, then I think you say, like, fire chief is almost like head of security first. And then you go down the line. So they are saying the people who have appeared to have snuck in to the boundaries that is Jarden, and they are saying F your effing wristbands, all this stuff. So now we're starting to get some sort of idea that perhaps the people who are supposed to be there have some sort of wristbands, while those who are not supposed to be there are real sticking out, obviously, because they don't have the right bands.
This must happen all the time. Michael doesn't give them a second glance. It's just the camera lingers on it for our benefit, but Michael doesn't stick around. He just keeps going.
Yeah.
And he finds his way out into the woods where there's a cabin lit up by Christmas
cabin?
Lights.
What's the right word? Would you say it was like kind of
like a
trailer?
Single wide trailer.
Yeah. So it's like a trailer. And yeah, it has like Christmas lights wrapped around it a little bit.
Knocks on the door. A man answers. Michael gets straight to business. He says, "You want to pray?" And the guy says, "Okay," and lets him in.
Yeah. So the first thing I thought was, whoa, has this man's house been burnt down? Is that why he lives in this trailer in the woods? And like, is this kind of some sort of strange? Because Michael didn't say to Dad, "Oh, I'm going to go visit Mr. whomever, whomever." He appeared to just be bringing food to our tower friend. So this was kind of like a little side jaunt that made me wonder if this is one of John's victims.
I didn't give him any value other than this is another Damon Lindelof cabin in the woods.
Oh, my. Okay, well, that makes sense. So now we open on the next morning, and we have John opening the front door, and there is a very beautifully wrapped mystery pie.
And it is an expertly made pie.
Yeah, it looks good. Homemade. But John picks it up and glances back and forth, super skeptical. Again,
there is no calling card, no nothing.
But this is the kind of moves you would have if you were a guilty dude.
Just so happens that he has been drawn out to his porch to pick up this pie at the exact moment that the Garveys, new lineup including Nora Durst and little Waynette, the baby Tom dropped off on their porch, jump out of the dog killer's Dodge Ram with a U-Haul in tow and go up to the house next door to the Murphys.
And in the background, a song is playing called Rockin' in the Same Boat. And this kind of struck me real quick because it just gives this vibe of like Kevin and John are going to be somehow thrown in the same situation together. And or even though they've had very different departure circumstances, somehow they're rocking in the same boat. Something crazy is going down.
The music starts just as John is kind of eyeing up Kevin. And Kevin, although he doesn't look like, you know, New York City or something like that, he doesn't really look Texas yet either.
No.
He kind of stands out.
He does kind of stand out. John and him, right? They give each other like kind of the manly nod, like, "I acknowledge your existence." John turns around and heads in with his pie to Erica, who is hilarious about this. She's like, "What is that? Hey."
He's very skeptical about it. And she's like,
"This is so funny,
though. Do you think someone's trying to poison you?"
And he makes this face that's like, and then Erica, somebody's like, "Ooh, you should see your face right now." Like, it is so, I loved how they played that scene. Oh my gosh, these two actors have got this rapport down perfectly.
John wants to invite the new neighbors over on his birthday for dinner. And Erica has,
she's so suspicious. Like, what is your scene? What is your angle,
but
John Murphy?
The way she says it caused Caroline and I to have a little discussion because she says, "You want to work on your birthday?" And we couldn't decide with what we've been given so far what she meant by work.
So, like, we know, like, if I were to invite people over for dinner, Mr. Daly, that would be work for him. It would definitely feel like hosting people at the house is definitely going to be work. You know, it's not the type of thing. If we say, "Hey, it's your birthday. Why don't we invite a bunch of people over here and you can entertain them or be a host?" That's not the position Paul necessarily would want to be in.
No, I would consider, she's exactly 100% correct. If any of our listeners are ever invited to our house, just know that it is work to have you there.
And that's super nice talk, but we enjoy your visit.
But that is true.
It is.
That is how.
And for every family, though, in all honesty, it is. I mean, it's not, can he sit around in his underwear and eat his ice cream and watch the Perfect Strangers TMZ report? No, I mean, he's got to be social. There's going to be cleaning up. There's going to be cooking. You know, everything. It's not going to come super easily.
But you took it more as more of an active, you are functioning in your role as unofficial sheriff.
Well, I did. I took it like he was in charge of sizing Kevin and family up. And he wasn't going to allow even one 24-hour period go by before he started having some serious conversations with them, because he was ready to know where they were from, what they were doing, what their intentions were, what this makeup is. Because for those of you who may only have the benefit of our podcast, if you did not know, Lil Wayneette is Black, and Kevin and Nora and Jill are white. So right away, there might be a story here that he wants to know, hey, what's going on? Where'd you get this little girl? So John takes the suspicious pie and knocks on the Garvey's door and presents the pie as a welcome gift.
And it's pretty funny because Nora's like, did you make this pie? And as almost any non-baking husband can honestly just kind of smile and say, no, I did not. And it's kind of just understood that, no, I didn't. And someone did. And that's all you need to know.
But you know what? Okay, this exact sliver of his personality is the exact same sliver that I was talking about him letting Michael put his hand down the garbage disposal. If any portion of him thought that garbage disposal was going to start up, why did he let Michael put his hand in?
Right.
This sliver of his personality is
really poison pie.
If it's poison pie, why are you going to go give it to a lady and a baby? Like, that was like, ooh, you have a little tinge of something in you where you can think something's really bad and horrible for you, but you are willing to let someone else suffer.
Interesting.
That's a little wiggy.
Yeah. Got to keep our eye on John.
Oh, John. John's got layers, man. He's got layers. So John invites them over for a barbecue for his birthday, and he presents it like, just stop in, make an appearance kind of thing. Definitely making it seem like this is going to be a large gathering and a big birthday party.
All the while that John and Nora are talking, there are some bangs and booms coming in from behind Nora in the house. John kind of asks about what's going on. Nora says, oh, we're just moving in, just, you know, moving in noises. She doesn't really even look behind her to check and see what it is.
Also in this exchange, the information that the baby has been named Lily. So this is Lily Garvey, which we would like to make a little side note as well, that Damon had characters in Lost named John, Michael. There was the actress named Evangeline Lily. And there are several others that match up. So now we've got John Murphy. We've got Michael as the son. Evangeline is the girl's name, the daughter, Evie's name. And now Lily, the baby. So we got lots of little connections there, Damon.
It's got to be intentional.
It's got to be. Evangeline is not a very common name.
Move to the Murphys' backyard, and the Murphys are getting ready to receive visitors.
And now we see that they do have a change in roles. As Paul was saying, that a non-baking dad,
That was totally wrong.
We have Erica over manning the grill, and she says, you make sure they eat meat? And John, I love the way he talks, says, I invited them to a barbecue. That would have been the time to tell me.
It was very laid back and sort of like, that's their problem and not mine if they don't want meat.
Yeah, I love it. Love it, love it. Yeah, and here in Texas, if we say barbecue, we don't mean hamburgers and hot dogs. That, I understand elsewhere, that is having a barbecue, but they're not having a barbecue. They are eating barbecue, and so that means meat. There's no other way around it.
Preparation time doesn't last very long before the Garvey clan makes their way around the house and introductions are made between all members of the family.
But it is real quick that Kevin's like, oh, you know, are we early? What's up? Because there's no one else there.
Right. I thought this was a birthday party.
Right? And then John's like, oh, yeah, no, we don't have any friends. And then the family like looks at him. Everyone's like, but then everyone bursts out laughing. So it was like, Wow, leftovers. We don't usually get all these laughs. This is a lot of jokety joke.
They put down Lily on a blanket where Evie, Michael, and Jill start talking. Evie just tosses out there.
So did you adopt her or did your mom F a Black guy?
Jill not only laughed, but she did kind of her donkey laugh.
Snort from Best of the Garveys, episode 9.
Which I think is an indicator of where Jill is,
yes.
Kind of emotionally, behaviorally.
Love it. Kind of returning to her old pre-departure self. Erica and Nora are lovingly looking on, and Erica's saying, oh man, it's so nice that your daughter is so good with the baby. And Nora fills in any new audience members that, no, actually, Jill is Kevin's. not mine. And Erica's like, oh, well, you know, she's a good looking kiddo. She's so pretty. And she says, oh, yeah. And, you know, so Kevin is pretty, too. Love it. Nora goes, his secret is moisturizer. Oh, my God. So cute. Again, sassing it out. And I would like to say in parentheses, Justin Theroux's wife, Jennifer Aniston, is the spokesperson for Aveeno Moisturizer.
Oh, that's funny.
So I'd like to throw that out, that perhaps that was a little nod wink. Moisturizer's the key.
They keep talking, and Nora reveals her only family is a brother, Matt Jameson, and he's already down here. And Erica says, oh, I've already met him. Back inside the house, the gender reversal on typical kinds of stuff, where Erica was manning the barbecue, we have John inside frosting his own birthday cake. Kevin has brought the manly contribution to the barbecue of beer, and he wants to know where to put it. The fridge is where you put it. He offers John a beer, and John says, I don't drink, but help yourself, which Kevin does.
So Kevin is completely turned on his investigator cop eyes. And as he's popping the top on the beer, he's scanning the room. You can see him look at all the stuff on the fridge, glancing around the kitchen. And his eyes go to the living room, the front room. And he just actually awkwardly stands there staring for a
very
minute.
Very uncoolly just stops.
Just staring.
And John's like, what you looking at? And Kevin, I am pretty sure, lies and just says, oh, we had that same couch. I don't know what he saw, but I don't think he cared a lick about that couch.
We even freeze framed it to try to see, like, is he looking at something? What does he see there? What can we see there? We could not see anything. I'm going to be sad if that comes back to bite us and there was something very obviously in the frame that we just missed. But he said we had the same couch, but I'm with Paul. I think he was either thinking about something else, hearing something else, seeing something else, something we're missing.
Kevin kind of makes some excuses, and we can see over his shoulder that John is kind of giving the does not compute head shake. Like, what in the world is this man about?
Well, and like, oh, Papa Duty, we got a loony. Like, just totally not like, oh, good. Me and Kevin are going to be awesome friends. Kind of more like, this guy's got something loose here.
Time passes. It gets dark outside. We're in the backyard now listening to Erica embarrass her children with a story about them leaving the water on in the bathtub.
So through this story, she reveals that the kids were 5 and that they almost didn't make it to 6. So this was the first time I realized that Michael and Evie are actually twins. So that's interesting.
It is.
Again, Damon enjoys a good twin pairing as we had Esau and Jacob were twins.
The Man in Black and Jacob. Yeah, you got me.
In Lost. So we know that Damon's got a thing for twins. And oftentimes the twins are kind of opposites from one another. We've got a girl and a boy, kind of a person who is a little bit more honest and religious and sort of sensitive, and one who's like a little more raucous and rule breaking and whatever. So
this was sort of a trap, this conversation.
It was a trap.
Because I forget which, but they say, oh, that must have been something to come home
Kevin
to.
Kevin says, oh, wow, that must have been something to walk into.
And John says, oh, I was in prison.
They all laugh along, and Kevin's like, oh, yeah, you know, how long were you in prison? Bah, ha, ha, ha.
And John knows specifically something about
6 years, 119 days. And now the conversation is embarrassingly fizzling. Erica, completely again, just like cool with it, is like, yeah, they think you're joking. And so John's like, go ahead and ask.
And Nora's like, oh, it's none of our business. And Kevin, before she even finishes the sentence, says,
what'd you do?
What'd you do? This is as cool as you can be. He says, attempted murder. And Kevin says something like,
what happened? Like, he just wants to know, like, what went on here? What happened?
John lets a beat take place. He just, nothing. And then he goes, I didn't try hard enough. And then the cake is on its way out.
That was awesome. Again, like mic drop, boom, like just constantly zinger after zinger. So it turns out that Evie is in charge of being the cake presenter, and they're all singing happy birthday to a fully lit, well-frosted cake by Mr. John. And right as we're getting to the big climax of our happy birthday, Evie zones out
and drops the cake fully lit. She stares off into the distance, and her parents know what is going on immediately, but the Garveys are left kind of like,
what's happening? What's happening?
What are we seeing?
But immediately Erica jumps up, starts calling to her, Evie, Evie, come back, come back, come back. Evie does, and sort of like, you know, shakes her head like a, like, did I go away? Erica explains that Evie has epilepsy and that these staring spells are controlled with medication, but that she must have forgotten her medication.
Nora doesn't want this cakelessness to make the evening end on an awkward note. So she has a brainstorm. The pie, she yells.
This is awesome. So John's face is like, not the freaking pie.
But Kevin departs to get the pie.
She's like, go get the pie. Hurry up. It's in the kitchen. Go get it. So, oh my God. So she's like, do you have any more candles? And the scene ends with John sort of walking like, babe, we have any more candles? Like, I'm going to have to eat this poison pie. Like, it's like you can't get away from it. It's kind of amazing.
Later on, the Garveys are leaving. John gives Kevin one of those it's not a friendly handshake. He, instead of just shaking and letting him go, he shakes and pulls him closer and says, I'm looking forward to getting to know you.
It is the type of like, it's the same move you do when you point at your own eyes and then point at the other person. Like, it's like, yeah, we're going to be real close here. I'm going to know your business. And again, it's done in this way that's like smooth, and John is always smiling, but it's that like, yuck, kind of feeling.
At the same time that the Garveys are leaving, a car pulls up, a white car that we recognize with the teen girls in it. It's time for Evie to go out with her friends for the night. Her dad gives her a curfew of 11, and off she goes.
I feel like it's important at this point that Evie hands him a present, and she says, don't open it now, because it's the greatest present you've ever gotten, and I don't want you to make a scene. I feel like, given how the rest of this episode is going to go, that present is going to rear its little head.
That's interesting.
So all the roles are reversed once again here. So we have Evie going out, and you have boy Michael sitting at home, like kind of saying his prayers and, you know, brushing his hair and whatnot. It's the type of thing that normally in these shows you kind of see the boy go out, raise hell, maybe even in, you know, inviting Jill or something. But nobody invites Jill. I kind of thought that was a little weird. I kind of thought, in all honesty, I thought Evie would say, hey, let me introduce you to my friends. You know, you want to come over kind of thing. Or do you want to go out
so
too?
I thought so too.
But no, she was not enveloped in that group. So interesting.
If you let yourself be manipulated by the editing, you would probably see that the camera lingered on the introduction between Jill and Michael for just a few frames.
For sure, yes. Where it seemed like they were kind of interested in one another.
Yes.
I agree. Totally agree.
The house is asleep later that night, and the camera's kind of looking around, and we see that the place starts shaking crazy this time. Not just a little tremor, but a very serious earthquake is happening.
The shelves are falling down, and Erica and John jump out of bed, and they start running towards the doorways for a safe space, is to stand in the doorways. So they yell to Michael, and Erica are now standing in the doorway, and John runs to Evie's bedroom door, opens it up, and is screaming for her, and they can all see her bed is empty.
Things calm down, at least earthquake-wise, and they start calling and texting Evie's phone. Evie has a charmingly witty teenager greeting on her cell phone about admiring the persistence of the caller for getting all the way to her greeting, but she's not answering. Michael knows of the spot where the girls go swimming, and this is the only idea that they have of places that they could go look.
Well, it's revealed while they're sitting there that Erica calls the one parent's household, that of one of the girls that she's with, and they say, you know, no, Evie's not there. And simultaneously, the phone starts ringing, the house phone, and it's the other girl's parents.
Looking for them, yeah. It's
confirmed all three girls that went out together, none of them are home. It's interesting. I guess it shows that every family must have been awoken by the earthquake, so everybody realized at the same time that the girls were not there.
John and Michael hop in the truck and head out.
They're going to go back to that same exact swimming hole location that we had seen from the very beginning.
As they pull up, they can see the white car, a four-door Mercedes, is sitting off in the distance with its lights on. As they get out, they can see that it's running and the radio is up pretty loud.
John tries to go ahead and open the door, but the doors are all locked. And so he thinks really quickly to get his cell phone out and to dial Evie's phone number, thinking they must be right close by. But unfortunately, the phone starts ringing and it's inside the car.
He doesn't quite know what to make of this. And before he can put it together, things get more complicated as Michael calls from the distance and he says, "Dad, the water's all gone." He calls him to the rim of the swimming hole and they look and they can see a bunch of fish flopping around on what used to be the bed of the
swimming hole where the girls have been swimming. And you can see that there is a large crack in the center of the swimming hole and it's kind of open.
And there is not enough water in there at all anymore. It's just puddles and fish.
Flopping fish. So John screams, "Evie!"
Final shot of the episode is Erica sitting at her kitchen table with the camera slowly pulling back as she's sitting there. I don't know if she's praying, but she's very quiet, kind of meditative, focusing on something. And as the camera gets way far back, you hear a chirp, cricket.
So as I'm looking at this scene, the main visual that I'm reminded of is Nora sitting alone at her kitchen table with the rest of the family having departed. And so looking at the way that they framed the shot, she's kind of off to one side and it's like the rest of that space is empty and that cricket chirp is there. And to me, going back to the cricket, you know, whether that cricket is supposed to be ominous and foretelling of a death or a soul being missing from the body, or whether that chirp is coming from a place of a good luck and
good
prosperity
fortune
for that family. Certainly during that cheep, that made it very much feel like a death, you know, certainly a death. The ending song is Fern Jones' Let Tomorrow Be, and it definitely was a good end cap to our first song, Let the Mystery Be.
I put an article on our webpage saying that I didn't agree that this was a reboot, but I will go along with the idea that this is a retool. This is the same show, obviously, same characters, same situation, but they've taken the good parts, the mystery and the tension, but they've made it easier to watch.
They have, yeah. Even from the opening credits, you know, we go from that extremely religious and
graphic,
painful, right, start of you know, this fresco type painting to instead these sort of candid pictures with individual people missing. It feels like it's easier to look at, but at the same time it still holds all the same, you know, sadness and longing. Although now that we have the Garveys with the Murphys, we definitely have this definite mix of some other adults to kind of bounce off of, because when we were back in Mapleton, there wasn't like another couple or another family that Kevin and Jill hung out with. You know, we just had this kind of rogue Amy hanging around. But now that we have them acting as a family unit with baby Lily, and now we have this other family, I think we're going to see all kinds of dynamics that we've never got to see before.
I'm really super excited to see how it goes. We have seen the next episode, but I can't wait to see it again, actually.
I agree.
I know what's coming, but
we watched it.
It really adds, coming from the point of view of this whole new family, doesn't really take away from the plot that we enjoyed with the Garveys. This really, I think, just adds texture and kind of thickens the plot, if you will.
I love it.
Makes it even more interesting than it was.
And definitely, you know, adding in Evie's wit and John's, you know, way with words. I love the dynamic between Erica and John. I think that the relationships between all of them are very authentic and you know, I love all the realistic little parts that they put into the show.
So we look forward to live tweeting as these shows come out. We actually gained the actress that plays Evie as a Twitter follower.
Yay!
Thanks to our witty live tweeting last night.
And sadly, we missed her in the lineup. She was the very first one that came out, so we didn't get a chance to get the National Geographic over to her, but we look forward to hopefully future events where we'll get a chance to see the cast again.
We look forward to chatting with you guys next week.
Thanks for listening, pod people. Thanks for listening to my mom and dad.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Just go home, folks.